It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're talking about what it's like to travel alone as a woman.
But first, we're talking about a plan to expand a new kind of assessment in Milwaukee's public schools, one that does not use traditional letter grades.
The school system says they're starting to use a new way to grade students that gives teachers and parents a better idea of how well they're learning. This program is not new, but it's now being extended to all schools in the Milwaukee Public School District.
Ann Nackert and Tina Flood joined us earlier to explain what Milwaukee's new grading system will be and why they're changing. Tina is the Chief Academic Officer for Milwaukee Public Schools, and Ann is an Instructional Technology Curriculum Specialist. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
And Tina, thank you so much for being here as well.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
So, Tina, let's start with you. The Milwaukee School District is moving away from the A through F grading system for K through 8 students. Why the move?
Well, I think what people have to understand is this is not something new to the district. We've actually been working on this for 5 years. It's been a process over time, but we're really doing it because it's best practice for kids and for their parents to truly help them understand what their kids know and are able to do. So if you think about a traditional letter grade, so if we tell a parent your child has earned a C in math, you have to do a lot of digging to really understand what that C means. Whereas if you take mathematics and break it apart into the standards, you can then report to a parent how their child is doing on the different standard areas. So for example, number and operations versus mathematical practices versus, you know, another standard in math.
And now, Anne, as I understand it, the new system will sort of decouple academic achievement from sort of the social aspect of things. Can you explain that decoupling and how that works?
Sure. For the last 5 years, we've had schools that have been using this new report card. We've phased them in over the last 5 years. And from the beginning, we separated academic achievement from non-academic factors. And so in each content area, besides listing the standards in that content area, like the math standards that Tina was saying, we also include a line where teachers can indicate the effort in that content area, since we know some students really love math but may not like to write, or vice versa. And then we also have an additional section that we call personal social development, and that section has a series of items that are sort of those process skills, how kids do school. And in that area, the teacher can indicate whether a student turns work in on time, whether a student gets along with their peers, shows respect for adults, and a number of other items. So it really allows the parent to see both academic and non-academic progress.
And Tina, instead of an A through F is what we're used to seeing, the traditional grading scale, what will students see on their report card and what will it mean?
So it's broken out into four different categories. So they would see advanced, proficient, minimal, and basic. And that actually mirrors our other assessments, that terminology. So it's terminology that parents are familiar with.
So it's going to be, what did I see, like a PR will be proficient. And, I mean, it seems like with these new levels, parents are going to need to get used to this. Kids are going to need to get used to this. Is it going to be a big sea change in how parents and students think about school and their performance there?
So as we've already stated, we've been working on this for 5 years. So we've done a lot of work to help educate parents and students. We have a parent resource guide that's available on our portal where it really explains the entire process and then what the report card looks like, what the different levels mean. So we think we've done a lot of work to really help parents understand what this means for their student.
And according to advocates, this is supposed to better serve the Common Core standards that lots of places are voluntarily adopting. How do you see that working together?
Well, I think regardless of the standards, whether it's Common Core or the Wisconsin Model Academic Standards, the whole point is to really give parents and students a better idea of how they're performing against those standards.
And critics are saying that it's just going to make it harder to find failing students, that it might blur the line between who's succeeding and not succeeding. And Milwaukee Public Schools have been struggling for a while with this. And, you know, critics are looking at it and saying this is just making it harder to pinpoint, you know, the failure of the schools or the students. What do you say to that?
I totally disagree. I think the opposite is, in fact, true. I think this will help us do a better job of really identifying where students are being successful, and then it will also help us identify areas that students still need support and more work on.
Now, what about homework? Homework has been, you know, a staple of what students go through in school. They have to turn it in, and it counts for part of their grade. How does homework factor in with this new system?
So homework is still important because we want students to be able to practice at home, but what we want is students to have multiple opportunities to show that they're proficient or that they can be successful towards a standard. So the homework is turned in, but we're more concerned about how they're doing on the homework, and again, giving them multiple opportunities to show that versus did they get it in on time and how many points is this worth. So we're not saying that homework's not important, but we want to make sure that we're keeping everything in context and providing students multiple opportunities to show success.
And Tina, what sort of feedback are you getting so far from people, from parents especially?
I think once we bring parents in and we're able to explain it to them and they go through parent-teacher conferences where they're able to sit down with their teacher and their student in some cases and they really walk them through what this means, I think parents have really been responding in a very positive way because it does give them more information about their child.
Now, Anne, one of the things I imagine that teachers might be concerned about is that this is more work for them. Instead of a single grade, although I suppose they were evaluating all of these things anyway and just rolling into the grade, but are teachers concerned that this is going to be a lot more work for them?
I think, again, once teachers get involved in the process, you know, change is hard for everyone, but when a teacher gets involved in the process, they realize that this is helping them in many ways. So in the end, it results in a grade that's divided up by standard, but in the meantime, it helps teachers do the things they're being asked to do anyways, which is differentiate their instruction based on the needs of the student. And this type of grading really allows the teacher to focus in on where those strengths and weaknesses are in their classroom and to really give students the interventions that they need.
Will it be easier, do you think, to pinpoint students who may be struggling with, you know, just the basics of being organized and turning in homework and things that are more sort of less about understanding and more about the mechanics of what makes learning happen?
I think that's the interesting thing about being a teacher is that you play many different roles. So not only are you teaching children academically, but you're teaching children how to behave socially, you're teaching them how to be responsible, and none of those things have moved away. A teacher is still doing all those things. But I feel like in this system, it's in a less punitive manner, meaning our goal isn't to say, gotcha. Our goal is to help kids, support kids, and help them be as successful as they can be.
Now, I don't know if you've been following some of the coverage of this. This sort of broke this morning. You've been aware of it and have been tracking it for a long time. But just reading the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article this morning, a lot of comments there, a lot of people who are dubious about this, critical of it, and you know, some people saying it points to, you know, the slippery slope of American schools heading downward. What do you say to reassure those people, Tina?
Well, I think I think people make comments sometimes about things that they don't truly understand. And I think if we had the opportunity to really sit down and explain this to people and walk them through it, they would be less quick to react with those kind of statements.
But what about actually standing up for it as a merit-based thing, about why you think it's worth doing?
Again, I would have to go back to this is best practice, and it really does give us more information about students, and it helps us communicate on a deeper level to parents about where their students are compared to the standards.
Now, this is only used, as I understand it, for kids in grades K through 8, so why not high school?
So there's two things you have to keep in mind. So we have the standards-based report card, which is the actual tool, which we're using in grades K through 8. And then there's the whole idea around standards-based grading, which is the practice. And we do have many of our high schools who are working on reflecting on their grading practices and really moving towards standards-based grading practices. But we have not moved the high schools to a standards-based report card at this time.
Do you expect to be doing that? Are there models of high schools who are doing just that?
I don't think we plan to do it anytime in the near future, but we certainly want to continue to work with teachers on their grading practices.
Now, will you be assessing, Anne, as you go along to see whether or not this is actually working for a big school district like Milwaukee?
Absolutely. We've done surveys of parents, we've done surveys of teachers, and we're really sort of paying attention to sort of the feedback that we're getting from all the different stakeholders.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
And Tina, thanks to you as well.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was Tina Flood, Chief Academic Officer for Milwaukee Public Schools, and Ann Nackert, an Instructional Technology Curriculum Specialist there.
The tales of travel writers have enchanted readers for centuries. The idea of going where the wind takes you and investigating the unknown has attracted some of the best men the literary world has to offer.
And that's just it. Most of those travel writers are, in fact, men. And there's more to it than which jobs are and aren't open to women. According to our next guest, going on adventures can be different for women. A travel writer herself, she says there's a voice in the back of her head warning her. Don't get yourself raped.
And because of that, she says she can't just go where the wind takes her, say yes to every experience that comes her way.
And that got us wondering, beyond just traveling, do some women forego adventures because they're worried about their personal security? Joining us from Belgrade, Serbia, is Tara Isabel Burton. She's a travel writer and Clarendon Scholar at Trinity College in Oxford. Her recent article in Salon is called The Dangers of Traveling While Female. Tara, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
You say you didn't realize you were subconsciously worried about being raped when you first began traveling. When did you start to realize that it was sort of this quiet whisper in the back of your head informing a lot of the choices that you were making?
I started traveling relatively young. My family moved around a lot when I was younger, and I'd started, when I was about 14 or 15, going out alone, and I'd realized that the way I was being treated in the street when I was still very much mentally a child and maybe physically didn't quite look like a child, the kind of attention I was getting was a sort of a combination of everything that you internalize as a child, don't talk to strangers, but a very particular threatening kind of attention that I hadn't necessarily expected. And I think getting that kind of attention early on and having people really willing to not only press boundaries but take advantage of the fact that often as when you're that young, you're nervous about saying no or please leave me alone or behaving in a way that seems impolite to adults. And I think early on I realized that there were people who would be very keen to test or push my boundaries and do what they could regardless of my comfort level, even if it was a case of just talking to me, asking for my number, asking for my name. And I think that's an experience that even though I'm older and better able to take care of myself, really stuck with me and informed how I do travel even now.
Now, you're a travel writer now. You make your living doing this, and you've been all over the world. And, you know, I'm sure that you've read the guidebooks and the advice for women traveling alone, how to keep yourself safe. Even with all of this knowledge that you have and all of this experience, how big a factor is that worry, that fear of being raped and maybe murdered along with it? How does that inform what you do now that you're older?
I'd say that the sort of the fear of being raped or being murdered, these sort of very big fears, are not always at the front of my mind as much as a fear of getting in an awkward, potentially violent position that's not necessarily me being, you know, hit on the head and dragged into the back of a van, but me being in a room alone with someone in the back of a shop, or I was in an art gallery the other day in Tbilisi, and I ended up in a back room alone with a man who, as I was looking at these paintings, made it very clear that, you know, he started saying, you know, you're young, you're here alone, you don't have a boyfriend, and immediately my brain started going, I've got to look for the exits, I've got to make sure that I'm close to the light, I've got to see, you know, is anyone else in shouting distance. You know, it's very much a case not of worry about serious physical harm, but worrying about getting into those kind of uncomfortable positions where you do have to shout, you have to scream, you have to be violent, as I've had to be a couple of times. And unfortunately, that mild worry does color interactions because it's difficult to, let's say, this owner of an art gallery is trying to show me around. On the one hand, I want to be in the moment. I want to listen to the stories he has to tell. I want to absolutely sort of engage in a meaningful interaction as a writer, as a traveler. That's what traveling's all about. And there's just that pervasive sense of, well, if something does go wrong, if something does get awkward, where are the exits? How can I leave? And that makes it difficult to be really in the moment in the way that I'd like to be.
You've talked about this with some of your male friends who travel as well and who do things like crash on the couch of somebody they just met, except ride somewhere, are able to kind of be pretty footloose and fancy free when they're traveling. And one of your male friends said, can't you just get over it? What do you think about that? Can you just get over it, or is this something that's just going to be with you forever?
I don't think I can just get over it in the sense that I can't snap my fingers and make and make my situation, my experience, very different. I think I can work towards examining why I always prioritize sort of safety over adventure. I think many women growing up are taught, stay safe, don't take the subway late at night, don't wear clothes that call attention to yourself. Men are often taught, children, make mistakes, maybe you'll break a few bones, maybe you'll get a bit muddy, but that's fine, it'll be all right in the end. To some degree, I think there is, it falls to me to examine, am I being overly cautious because I'm afraid of, shouting at someone, I'm afraid of a confrontation, and therefore I'm holding back. To some extent, I think it's worth saying, women should embrace some degree of risk and not always feel that sort of being extra safe at the cost of an experience or an adventure is always the way to go. At the same time, I don't think any amount of positive thinking or getting over it or willingness to go and do these kind of things will change the fact that often the way I am in public, my gender always, well, not always, but often becomes the first thing about me. If I accept an invitation, if some stranger says, do you want to stay on my couch? I can say yes, but me saying yes to a male stranger is often not the same thing as a man saying mm-hmm. yes to a male stranger. There's a sense that, in being so open and in accepting invitations and at talking to strangers, in many places that's perceived as me expressing sexual interest
right.
or expressing
well,
consent.
And I want to ask
so
you,
the way people respond to me.
As a travel writer, you look up to some of literature's most famous male travel writers. And how do you think your experience differs from some of these big names in the travel writing world as a woman?
I suppose it's the one that I wrote the article about and the sort of one of my favorite travel writers is Patrick Leigh Fermor, who had all these adventures walking across Europe and slept in everything from haystacks to the home of countesses. And I'd love to be able to do that. And of course, Patrick Leigh Fermor wrote in a particular time, in a particular place, a member of a particular social class, as well as being a man. So he had those particular privileges. But I don't necessarily have that same freedom to see a haystack and say, well, I'll sleep here. I don't have to plan ahead. Oh, this group of shepherds in Crete has invited me to spend the night with them by their fire. Yes, of course I'll do that. I do have to be more reticent. But sometimes I think that there's a positive element to that. I think sometimes by letting go of this idea of I have to have an adventure, I let go of the idea that I have to be this lady adventuress or be the heroine of my own story, and that frees me up to listen to the stories of those around me, to watch and learn and sort of be less present in the story because I can't sort of go off and have these great sort of adventurous, risky experiences. Often I have access to experiences that male travel writers don't have and wouldn't often be considered adventures by Patrick Leigh Fermor or what have you. I have access to women's experiences. I've had landladies in places that I've lived. I've had the mother of a friend sit down at a kitchen and confide in me her worries about her son in the mountains of Sfaneti a few weeks ago in Georgia. These experiences aren't necessarily considered adventurous by common standards, but I think they're a hidden kind of adventure. They're the adventures and the experiences of 50% of the population that often get left out of a Patrick Leigh Fermor's narrative or Bruce Chatwin's narrative.
Now we've only we've only got about a minute left, but I do want to ask you. I mean, you write about how some of these great male travel writers they write from a position of what you call unthinking privilege. What do you think your experience brings that's equally valid?
Well, I think I too have sort of a degree of privilege when I travel, of course, being often, financially freer than many in a place like the Republic of Georgia where I travel does give me, like Patrick Leigh Fermor, a degree of sort of unthinking privilege that I think, well, I ought to be able to go here and do anything. But I think traveling as a woman and realizing, sometimes my own experiences lead me to have to think about that, to have to hold back, to examine, mm-hmm. to examine the degree to which I ought to be sort of throwing myself out and having adventures, allows me to, sometimes I think, be a better traveler. I check myself, as it were, if I am seeking an adventure at the expense of engaging authentically with a culture.
And I think we have to leave it there. Tara, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but it's been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Tara Isabella Burton, freelance writer and a Clarendon Scholar at Trinity College in Oxford. And what do you think? If you're a woman, do you say no to travel adventures that come up because you're worried about safety? And does it interfere with your joy of travel? Post on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking with a politician named Ron Paul. I think you've heard of him, about his idea for fixing the American education system.
And we'll hear from the director of the Betty Ford Clinic about the challenges of addiction and how to overcome them.
Coming up after the news, it's Wisconsin Talk. We'll chart our way through the different dialects of the Dairyland. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Evshinsky. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Noah Evshinsky in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. One of the most important things about being from Wisconsin is the way we talk. The Upper Midwest accent is recognized nationwide and allows Wisconsinites to be identified immediately.
But what is the Wisconsin accent, or accents, I should say, and how did they come about? We're talking about it with, well, I can only call him an expert in linguistics right now. He's sitting right next to me.
And we're curious about what you think the Wisconsin dialect is. What expressions or pronunciations stand out to you as distinctly Midwestern, maybe distinctly Wisconsin? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Here to explain what the Wisconsin dialect is and perhaps what it isn't and how it came about is Joseph Sammons, co-editor of Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
It's good to see you. So let's start with the basics. I'm going to throw you a softball here. What is the Wisconsin accent?
That's a softball? Well, there's not a single Wisconsin accent, first of all. And it's not something that's fixed in time. It's actually happening right now. It's developing. It's getting becoming much different, getting much stronger in some ways. People from Sheboygan and Manitowoc sound very different from people in Milwaukee, and they sound very different from people in Eau Claire and La Crosse. So there's a set of accents. There's nothing – linguistic features don't start and stop at state lines. So there aren't really particular features that are found only in Wisconsin, not in the Upper Peninsula, not in Minnesota and so forth. But there's a cluster of features that together are enough to identify people from various parts of the state.
So you say that Wisconsin is one of the most linguistically interesting places in North America.
Absolutely.
What's so special about us?
It's the range of things that are happening here over time, how things are developing and changing. I'm from the South, as you'll hear eventually in my voice. And in the South, there are what some people call professional Southerners, people who make a living using a Southern accent and doing sort of a Southern shtick. We don't exactly have that so much in the Upper Midwest. There are a few people like that. But we've got this rapidly evolving, distinct English that people are starting to recognize. And really only in the last couple of decades that you have things associated with the Upper Midwest that are so linguistically recognizable. And that's because really clearly distinct Wisconsin English accents have only come about in the last generation or two.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you talk about a generation or two. You talk about language evolving. Well, if we're evolving, where did we start?
Well, obviously the native languages of Wisconsin are where it all starts, still spoken today, huge and really exciting efforts going into revitalizing these languages, having children learn to speak them as a first language or along with English. But then English comes into the state. I mean, French has some role, but English comes in as the first massive outside presence. And that's quickly joined by a whole bunch of immigrant languages, German, Polish, Norwegian, and so forth in large numbers. And together, this think about it. People who came here speaking English were from, say, New England or Pennsylvania, and they brought that kind of English. They came directly from Ireland. They came from England. They brought that kind of English with them. Their kids didn't grow up with just that particular accent, just that particular dialect, just that particular immigrant language. They heard all these different things going on around them. What kids do ultimately is build a grammar out of what they hear, how they hear people talk, how their peers talk, how they're going to do things. They make decisions about that, mostly unconscious, sometimes conscious. And those kids started to shape a new way of speaking that it was not found anywhere else and that reflected local patterns in remarkably rich ways.
How many generations are we talking about here? How quickly does it happen?
It takes at least three generations to develop a new dialect or a new language in those kinds of situations. Here, it's a lot slower because we think of 19th century, early 20th century immigrants coming in. And the stereotype is that they very quickly learned to speak English and gave up those languages. In fact, they didn't. Our research has shown that sometimes German-speaking immigrants to the state remained German monolingual. That is, they didn't learn to speak English for two or three generations. So you have third-generation Wisconsinites who only speak German. And so the process doesn't start for them until they start learning to speak English.
So because language is so wrapped up in culture and it was hard to let it go.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about the importance of kids and in the development of dialects. Now, and you talked briefly about Native Americans and the tribes here in Wisconsin. Of course, unfortunately, there is a history here in the state where kids who spoke their native languages were placed in boarding houses. You know, it happened across the country, including here in Wisconsin. They were taken out of their family unit and placed in a school where English was not only spoken but I would say promoted.
Well, where they were often physically punished for speaking their native language.
How did that affect the evolution of native languages and how that affects the dialect or dialects here in Wisconsin?
Well, people had different reactions to that kind of trauma of the boarding schools. A lot of people came back and would not speak their native languages. They learned English. They used English. They used English with their own children because they didn't want them to have those problems. There are cases throughout the country. You rightly say that this is a national issue. There are cases throughout the country of people who came back and said, well, no, I'm not going to change. I'm still going to speak the language that I speak. But you have English established. It really pushes the native languages in those communities to the margins because you have broken that chain of normal transmission. That's why there's so much effort underway today to revitalize Ho-Chunk, to revitalize Menominee and Potawatomi and so forth, to reestablish those kinds of traditions. But at the same time, you have English that is distinct in those communities so that people can use a few words of Menominee, a few words of Oneida, and identify themselves as part of the community and have distinct English accents.
Mm-hmm. Before we take a break, I just want to talk a little bit more also about, mainstream dialects, I suppose, here in Wisconsin. What are some of the sort of what are some examples of I'll call them Wisconsinisms? I don't know. Am I making that up? Is that a word?
Oh, is it a word? We can make new words. We make new words all the time.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's go with it. So before we break here, give me some example of some Wisconsinisms.
Well, in pronunciation, one of the things that when people from Wisconsin go outside the state, they often find people commenting on is how they pronounce the A sound before a G sound. So a word like bag is something that outsiders notice. I confess that I noticed it when I came here and heard people go to the store and you buy something and somebody says, you want to beg for that? So that's typical of most of the state as a whole. Typical of the western part of the state is that the vowels in a word like cot, meaning the thing that company sleeps on, and caught, the past tense of to catch are pronounced the same. That's coming in from the West pretty rapidly. There are lots of other things that are historically part of Wisconsin and other regions as well. The what we call stopping, so the TH sounds not being pronounced as th and the, but as duh, dim der does type things. There's a long list of them. That's just the ones from sound. There are things in grammar. There are things in vocabulary that are used here. Golden birthday is something that a lot of people outside of Wisconsin don't know, but it seems like most people in Wisconsin do know about it.
The thing, too, I'm a sort of a recent migrant to Wisconsin, and of course there are several things that I had no idea what they were until somebody pointed them out, a bubbler being one, you know, for a water fountain. The people are using the word bakery as not just a place, but actually a thing. The things that you can buy in a bakery, like, oh, the bakery's in the kitchen. Well, no. I mean, to me, it's like, well, the bakery's actually down the street. It's not in the kitchen. What's up with that?
Well, it's a case where some of the immigrant languages to Wisconsin have a word that is looks a little bit like bakery that means baked goods. But it's also not uncommon for names for things and places where those things are housed to flip flop. So there are lots of different things going on in cases like that.
We are talking to Joseph Sammons, co-editor of Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State.
And we want to know what you think about the Wisconsin dialect. What are your favorite Wisconsin expressions, Wisconsinisms, and figures of speech? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'll take your calls and hear some examples in just a bit. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky, and this is Central Time.
You guys coming with or no? Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You guys have stopper or no?
A clip there of one of the famous Wisconsinisms that we're going to hear more about in just a moment as we pick up our discussion with Joseph Salmons, co-editor of Wisconsin Talk.
So, there it is. You heard it. There it is.
Brilliant example from Rob Brackenridge, the comedian.
So you say we're evolving. And yep. Before we go to the phones, I just want to really very quickly. You say we're evolving. Where do you see our language going?
Probably going to surprise you with this answer. It's going to become more regionally diverse and not less regionally diverse. People are going to have stronger regional accents over the next couple of generations than they have now. And we've got really good evidence from that. We have recordings made in part by this organization, Wisconsin Public Radio, back from the 30s and so forth. And you play those for people here and you ask them, where are those people from? And they can't tell. They don't have a distinct accent. But if you go to Sheboygan or Manitowoc today, you go to La Crosse or Eau Claire, you hear young people talk, and they sound very regionally distinct. It's happening, and we can measure that acoustically. We can look at the physics of speech and see that going on and quantify it. So it's going to be more distinct, and it's going to continue in the directions that things are already headed. What the basic regions are is probably going to continue with more differentiation, in many ways, accents are going to get stronger. It doesn't mean all features are going to survive. So dim, der, does, for example, is relatively recessive. It's less commonly used than it might have been two generations ago. But while some features like that are fading, and er, no is probably fading, lots of other features are stepping up. So the overall pattern of diversity is going to increase.
All right. So we're talking about patterns and science and looking at it acoustically. Well, let's go to the phones. Let's talk about people's own personal experience with the Wisconsin accent. Our first caller is Eugene. Eugene, you notice accents were the same N and S of the Valley?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I live here in a little village of Biola. It's the Kickapoo Valley. The valley starts up at Wilton and goes south to where the Kickapoo empties into the Wisconsin down to Waseca. Now, it isn't. I don't think it's as pronounced as it used to this when I was a kid growing up here. But if you went 20 miles west, you'd pick up a different accent because you get over into the Norwegian area around Westby and around Viroqua. Now here, it isn't pronounced. Now, I can catch it in some of the older people. Their language is a little bit slower and also a little bit deeper.
Joe, have you seen
their way of speaking?
Joe, have you seen the speed change as well?
Yeah, and this is a very interesting part of the state with regard to that. The southwestern corner of the state, where the boundaries are, has changed over time, and it's not always completely clear. That's been a very distinct area for a long time because, exactly as the caller says, the settlement patterns have been different. The early Anglo settlements were in southwestern Wisconsin, so you have a very established, longer established pattern there. You have Norwegians, especially west and north of that area, and they're actually major dialect boundaries. You can basically bicycle from Mount Horeb to Mineral Point and hear the accents change as you go. Even today, it's certainly truer among older speakers, but it's still there today. And that southwestern corner is much more like Midlands English, like the English of parts of Iowa, northern Illinois, and so forth.
So within a bike ride's distance, dialects can be different.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's amazing. Eugene, thanks so much for your call. Elaine from La Crosse, do you have a Wisconsinism you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, one word that I use and my mother used and we use in our family is the word putsy. It means, you know, not complicated, but just has a lot of steps to complete it, like a recipe or something could be. It's not hard, it's putsy. And so when my daughter moved to Boston for college, she used that word to describe something, and the people there had no idea what she was talking about, putsy. So I didn't know if you had any history or could explain how that came about or where that came from.
I don't know that one. I've heard it, but I don't remember anything about it. But I can tell you exactly how to find out. Go to the Dictionary of American Regional English. I'll guarantee you it's in there. And if it's not, we can talk to the editors and find out. They must have data on that.
Let's go to Madison. Penny, you have a pronunciation for, well, what I say mayonnaise. How about you?
Mayonnaise with a Y. Mayonnaise.
These are pretty common differences regionally, where we have more reduced pronunciations and less reduced pronunciations. One of the classic examples that you hear a lot for that is the little sticks that kids use for coloring. Do you say crayon or crayon, or what do you say?
I say crayon.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm a crayon man myself.
Okay. I grew up with crayons.
So we talked a little bit about Southwest Wisconsin, and I noticed we've got one that I think, at least I've heard it, heard this word sound like this in Southwest Wisconsin. Barb, you've got a word there from Oconomowoc.
Yes, I grew up in Watertown, which is German in background. I always say wash instead of wash.
Oh, really interesting example. This is one of the things that I never expected to hear in Wisconsin. It's absolutely classic for, again, this Midlands area, sort of central Illinois, central Indiana, parts of Ohio, and so forth. And it has crept up into Wisconsin. I guess at this point, I'm not shocked to hear that you can get it in Watertown, but I've mostly heard it from southern, across really southern Wisconsin, Rock County and places like that. The story, the usual story is that there's a part of the South where people did pronounce R's at the ends of words and didn't pronounce R's at the ends of words, so that you get the park the car type pronunciations and park the car pronunciations. And where you have that situation, people will sometimes overcompensate. They'll think there's an R where there isn't one. And the story is, I don't know if it's true or not, but the story is that people did that in the case of wash and started producing wash. And it's very well established in the Midlands, and it has crept up into southern Wisconsin.
I want to just take one or two more calls here before we have to end the interview. Real quick, Evelyn from Nina, you think people can recognize the Wisconsin accent very clearly across the country?
Oh, yes. My husband and I were in D.C. recently, and as we were standing at the corner discussing where we're going next, this gal was behind us, and I thought, oh, she's waiting for something. Then she came up to us and said, "You're either from Wisconsin or Minnesota." and it's so wonderful to hear that accent. And also I want to comment on, in the fall of the year when the hunters come on, they say dis, das, dos, and dims. And it just irritates me that they cannot pronounce a TH. I don't know if it's from the valley here. I'm from Nina. If it's just their way of talking that they're excited to be on television or what.
So is it a Wisconsin thing or what is it?
It's certainly a Wisconsin thing. It's a Wisconsin thing. The dim, der, dos is something that adults who were trying to learn English, who were native speakers of, Polish or Yiddish or German, almost any other language, had great difficulty producing. So they just substituted D's for those sounds, and it stuck around. The thing is, it came in as this immigrant feature, but the caller is exactly right. We've been going around the state for several years now and talking to people about how they perceive speech in Wisconsin, and she said exactly what a lot of people say. Oh, this is how deer hunters talk. So it's gone from being something about having immigrant background to being something that's about a social group. And it's often characterized as rural as opposed to urban and so forth. So, yeah, that's absolutely absolutely there.
And I've been to one or two deer camps in my life, and I have to say linguistically things go downhill very quickly.
Well, downhill for you, I would say, as a linguist, it's uphill. It gets much more interesting.
Before we run out of time, one last question for you. Are there any words that we're exporting to the rest of the country where, you know, if you're on the East Coast or West Coast, you'll hear a word that maybe we originated here in Wisconsin?
There are a couple of things like that. One, I think when I was a kid growing up, brat in the sense of bratwurst was not something that I knew. That was not part of my vocabulary. But I think everybody in the country, I can go anywhere and talk about brats and people know what I mean. There's something else that is a little bit more of a structural grammatical feature that's spreading very rapidly and it has deep roots here in Wisconsin. And that is, Rob Brackenridge did it in the clip you played. Going to the store, you want to come with. To me, it has to be, do you want to come along or do you want to come with us or something like that? But up here, it's come with. And that, again, is because a lot of the immigrant languages that were well represented in Wisconsin had that as a construction. And it's just been sort of translated in to English. It's spreading very rapidly now. And you can hear it in most of the country. And it's certainly unsurprising to people. People don't regard that as very foreign. So, yeah, Wisconsin stuff is popular.
We talked about migration early, 100-plus years ago. But there's also recent migration.
Yes.
How is that, very quickly, how is that affecting dialects here in Wisconsin now, the recent migrations to the state?
Much less than earlier migrations. We'll take words from these situations as cultures come into contact and we pick up new foods or cultural traditions or something. But we now have a pretty fixed Wisconsin starting point for English, and people are buying into that, and it's developing. But it's not going to be reshaped the way it's just been shaped.
Joe, thanks for coming in today.
Happy to do it.
That was Joseph Sammons, co-editor of Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the preservation of comic books. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.